It's my distinct pleasure to introduce you to Matt Barnard, who I've known for a couple of years now, fellow member of the BSP on the executive. He's just about to complete his PhD on Heidegger and freedom. Very soon, I hope.
Yeah.
And he's here to talk to us at Manchester Metropolitan, and he's here to talk to us today about Heidegger and McCormack, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Over to you, Matt.
Yeah. Well, my name's Matthew, and I'm a Heideggerian.
Shoot him.
A very, very tired Heideggerian, nearing, as Donnie says, to the end of my PhD, limping across, and I see him everywhere. And although I get this invitation from Pat to work on a text that is quite different to what I usually work in, I open up the road, I open it up online, the Kukulé problem, and then see a bunch of Heidegger. So unfortunately, this talk is largely going to be me talking about MacArthur about 5 seconds, and then a lot of Heidegger to give the illusion of relevance. So hope you'll be happy with that. Now, I want to do justice to it, but I mean, as I am a committed and tired and very distraught Heideggerian, I mean, look how much I've read that. This book is falling apart. Like, literally, you know, you'll laugh, but my psyche is worse. But what does that actually mean? And I think to sort of parody or paraphrase is the actual word I wanted to use there. Something he says in Being in Time, it's not phenomenology and, I guess, Heideggerianism, they're not an assent to a set of discoveries, but rather a commitment to a certain method. And that method is largely, when confronted with a philosophical text, and I will be reading the Kukulé problem specifically as a philosophical text rather than bringing in the literature, because I am a Philistine, the question becomes, right, what is this text trying to do? What problem is it trying to address? And in some ways, we seem to have the answer in the title, which is the Kukulé problem, which is, as I understand it, the problem of what he calls the night shift. How is it that sometimes when we're dealing with a problem of thought, the unconscious steps in and lends a helping hand through a dream, with the Ouroboros or whatever image it decides to put towards us? And the problem is, why doesn't it speak? At least that's how I understand it. The problem is, why does the unconscious not speak to us? And the answer given is that the unconscious hasn't learned language yet. And the problem I have with that, first of all, sort of on a cursory reading of the text, is something that Will mentioned in his introduction to one of the other speakers, which is that it seems that the unconscious and language have been established as so separate, it's difficult to see how they could be put back together. And there's a, who is it who says like is, Donnie, we talked about this in the Schelling, didn't we? Like is known by like.
Empedocles.
I got that without any help. Empedocles said, like is known by like. It seems difficult. If we're really going to say unconscious is so different from language, how could they talk at all? But I think the reason that it's been put in this way, and this is, I guess, the critical aspect of what I want to say today, is that the way that McCarthy's thematized or presented the problem has limited the destructive and radical scope of the phenomenon that he's encountered, which I think is a very basic phenomenon and one that Heidegger has talked about as well. And indeed Freud and anyone dealing with the question of how is it that we can talk to ourselves? How is it that we can hide things from ourselves? Now, this phenomenon, which is factual, I mean, my understanding of Freud is that his development of the theory of the unconscious, something he really had to argue for, was precisely because in a Cartesian picture of what the mind is, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever to say that we could hide anything to ourselves or even talk to ourselves, because this is a binary relationship. So the best example I know is from Sartre's Critique of Freud, where he sort of articulates the problem as, how can you lie to yourself? Now, because lying is a binary relationship. On the one hand, you've got the liar who knows the truth and then deceives the one who is lied to with the truth that he is hiding. The truth is covered up and hidden from the person being deceived. But in the mind, if Descartes is right, we should have an absolute intuition of everything that's going on in our minds. We should know everything about it. Nothing can be mysterious in the mind as Descartes pictures it. So lying doesn't work, and yet we do deceive ourselves. So Freud says, well, I have to posit this unconscious, another mind that isn't conscious, where things are in the psyche, but we haven't got access to them. They're not available to us. Now, this phenomenon, I think, and certainly I'm going to be presenting Heidegger's own dealing with this problem from what's left of my copy of Being in Time. It's part of, as this entire book is, well, one of the things this book does will be a sort of attack or destruction of the idea of Cartesian subjectivity. And I think by not allowing the problem to be developed in as fundamental a way as Heidegger does, and being partisan, I warned you, McCarthy isn't quite able to allow the phenomenon to do that, to completely... Well, no, let me start that sentence again. I think the way that McCarthy's presented the problem is fairly fixed within certain presuppositions, for certain philosophical ways of looking at things, and I think the indications of that are some of the, I think, are a bit odd claims, like saying... He seems to want to say that language and thought are quite separate, which I find quite controversial. And I don't know, I mean, I might have misread this, but he says pictures and, so images and language are different things. But then he sort of talks about images as something symbolic. You know, it's a thing that, he talks about language as a thing that is symbolic. It presents something as, that isn't what it is, as something else. But pictures also do that, as we know from the "this is not a pipe" picture. So I feel like there's a lot of unclarified things going on in this admittedly short essay. And I want to kind of show how this problem's related to this more fundamental problem and see what Heidegger has to say about it, and that they come to a fairly similar conclusion, in fact, but not as bound up in the evolutionary model that McCarthy finds he has to use. Now, although there's kind of, like, I really like the paper actually, the Kekulé problem, sort of, it's quite self-effacing, and he seems to present this as something he stumbled upon, a curiosity between himself and his friends. Whereas, if we're committed to a Heideggerianism, as I'm condemned to a Heideggerianism, no philosophical problem occurs in isolation. You know, there's always something going on, and our task is to try and break that up into its basic components in order to get to a more basic treatment of it, which is just a basic statement of phenomenology. So, where does the problem come up for Heidegger? It comes up in the question of guilt, a lovely Catholic word. Now, what Heidegger's interested in is a kind of pre-moral reading of the phenomenon of guilt and conscience. And the ultimate answer that he gives is that it's the self calling itself back to itself, which is why I think it's relevant to the Kekulé problem. Because essentially what we're talking about is the ability of the self to talk to itself and the implications that's involved in that. Now, the answer that McCarthy gives is that the unconscious can't speak because it hasn't learned language yet, because it's an language is an evolutionary junior aspect of humanity, which we ourselves only have. Now, how does Heidegger address this? Well, ultimately, he wants to say that... Well, first of all, let's talk a bit about what he means by guilt, because on the one hand, we're talking about a fairly useful but not gut-wrenching problem, like what's that math, the answer to that maths problem I'm working on. Well, how has that got anything to do with guilt? So guilt for Heidegger is something felt in anxiety about the stakes of our ultimate existence and projects. Now, he gets to a sort of, starts off by talking about ordinary senses of guilt, which he defines as being the origin or ground of a lack in someone else. So if I'm in debt, I am guilty of that because I am the reason why there is a lack in my creditors' bank accounts. When it comes down to human existence, however, it's all about the possibilities that we may not take. And to try and take it away from the obvious moral connotations of guilt and responsibility, the example I want to give you is not moral at all, an example of which I'm sure we've all been through, not getting a job interview. Oh, sorry, getting the job interview and not getting the job. So getting quite close, which is usually, I don't know about you, a horrible experience. You know, involving all sorts of self-hatred, self-questioning. And what that is guilt in a Heideggerian sense, because what's happening is you are being directly confronted in a certain mood, your life understood as a set of possibilities you were in part responsible for. So you don't get the job, you don't go, oh, I didn't get the job, that has probably got nothing to do with anything that I could have or could not have done. You see all the things that you could have done. What if I wore a different tie? What if I was in a completely different sector? What am I doing? I've still not got the job I want. At this stage in my career, I've made some wrong life decisions, and it's all about how what we are or what we could be, the self, and us using that as a measure for our current factual situation. So we are currently in a certain situation, not having a job. That's not where we could be. It's not where we should be. It's not our authentic possibility. Now, so the conscience is calling to us in that moment. It's an experience, an encounter with our lives understood as existential possibilities. And Heidegger says, what does the conscience say? In hesitation marks, and that is guilty. But it doesn't say any words, Heidegger says. It doesn't use words. The question comes up then, why doesn't it use words? The same question as the Kekulé problem. And his answer is that language is about the other, which I think is possibly a more fundamental, not just, I'm not going to say it's a more fundamental understanding than McCarthy, but maybe a more fundamental understanding of what McCarthy's trying to get to. He says, the reason why the self can only speak to itself in silence is because language is about talking to other people. It's an outward projecting function of us. And so in order to cut through the hubbub of the public world, it speaks to us in silence. It conveys a discursive meaning without words, because words, I mean, I guess in some ways it's a similar claim to Wittgenstein's there is no private language. You know, words don't work aiming inwards. They are all about the world and talking about others and talking to others. He even says language gives us a Mitbefindlichkeit, a sort of co-finding each other together. Befindlichkeit being translated as state of mind in the book, a co-state of mind. Sort of before, in language, we experience ourselves together, whereas what we're talking about is the self, which is not something social in that sense. I mean, that's what I've sort of come to. Anyway, so, how are we doing for time?
How are we doing for time?
Good.
How long have I been talking for?
12 minutes. 12 minutes, so yeah.
Yeah, I'll wrap up then. Yeah. Yeah, so to sum up, I really like the Kekulé problem, but I think that what happens, because he's sort of using concepts like the unconscious and language without really problematizing them, without sort of breaking them up and saying, well, what do these words mean, which is a feature of the brevity of the text itself, he ends up saying something that I think is quite unsatisfactory, which is unconscious hasn't learned language yet, which is entirely within a very traditional, I would say, even Cartesian problematic of what's going on, whereas a Heideggerian method forces you to dig a bit deeper and then see a more fundamental version of that problem. And Heidegger's answer is that because language is for other people, we can't use it to speak to ourselves. Thanks.
Obviously, your talk raises a couple of really interesting points, at least from somebody who's not a Heideggerian, but has certainly enjoyed and loathed it reading Heidegger. So I guess the first one is, if you could share with everybody else in the room, and for those who, those of you who haven't read Heidegger or know very little about phenomenology, the issue of McCarthy's presuppositions and how you see Heidegger's destruction of the kind of classical model of consciousness in favour of the existential analytic, And I guess that kind of leads it to my second question. As a way of trying to understand, because obviously the notion of the unconscious doesn't really fit into a Cartesian framework, which is why it makes it quite slippery for phenomenologists, even for someone like Heidegger, who is very, very brilliantly kind of deconstructs that whole relationship, which of course he sees operating in Kant. Kant, of course, being the first one who began to undermine this distinction. Obviously, this leads into my second question. To say a little bit more about how guilt and indeed the kind of the call itself, could we begin to think about Heidegger in psychoanalytic terms? That there's a kind of, because obviously I'm thinking of Binswanger and the notion of an existential grasp of the notion of the unconscious as it's coming out of Heidegger. And I have a third question. just because the conscience calls in silence, does that necessarily preclude language in Heidegger? I'm not quite sure that is the case. If anything, it's a more authentic way into language. So we learn something about language that, unfortunately, in the public everyday world, is clearly, it's just simply closed off to us. So these.
I mean, questions. I think I've caught a sort of. I'm going to do this backwards.
Go ahead.
It's very hard to get, actually.
Indeed. It's very hermeneutic. You go ahead.
So I think what I've kind of run over quite quickly is I think he draws a distinction between language and discourse.
Yes, he does.
So I'm sort of using language to speak for that public version of communication, and then discourse, which he says when he's defining discourse straight away, can express itself in silence. So it's still discursive, it's still meaningful. So he certainly doesn't subscribe to what McCarthy says about sort of this language and image meaning being separate. He would presumably want to talk about the meaningful of images being something grounded in the discursive possibilities of Dasein, the human being. But cleaning up the terminology, something he says I was reading this morning to revise. That, you know, words can be attached to significations and interpretations, but you don't need to have the words to have an interpretation. You can still have that discursive meaning, just not necessarily with the words, which is why you miss what you want to talk about, like when you're giving a talk. The other one was, I mean, I don't know a lot about existential psychoanalysis. I know it exists. I'm aware of its existence.
I was just using it as an example. In the case of the existentiality, whether there's another way of thinking about this notion of the unconscious.
I mean, I think definitely. So phenomenologists, as you say, also don't like the unconscious, although they can talk about the phenomena as well. So Sartre, when he does this in Being and Nothingness, when he critiques Freud, he wants to be able to account for self-deception on the conscious level. By saying because we're not Cartesians, we don't have to have this absolute intuition of everything in our minds. So it's about, rather than splitting the mind up into conscious and unconscious, what phenomenologists will want to do is talk about the stuff that is within me, but which I'm not completely on top on, which I guess comes to you. This comes to your first question, which is, how does Heidegger surpass Descartes in this? I mean, one thing I always point out to my students when I'm reading Descartes with them in the meditations is that he really has to argue very, very hard for the separation of mind and body. Absolutely, he works very, very hard to get there. And the argument he uses, which is actually, it's not the only argument for the split between mind and body, but I would say it is suspect. He says, well, I think, therefore I am. I have an absolute knowledge of the fact that I'm thinking. Therefore, and I don't have an absolute knowledge of my body, therefore I am my mind and not my body. So because I do have this intuitional grasp, absolute grasp of my mind, that must be what I am, because I don't have that grasp of the body. And further, I can conceive of myself thinking without a body as well. It's sort of the intellectual separation, because we've got absolute knowledge of ourselves. That's how he pushes the mind away from the body, which, sort of going back to Aristotle, the phenomenological tradition wants to bring back together. And what I guess Heidegger says about that is that he's not being Cartesian enough. You know, he says he questions the ego and not the sum and the I think. Oh, sorry, the I am. So what Descartes doing is still bringing in certain presuppositions. He's not following the phenomena. The point of phenomenology is to engage with the things themselves, as he says, and to allow that to inform your interpretation and use your experiential interpretation rather than coming up with a framework and imposing that on reality, which is what Descartes does. And I'm not saying that's what McCarthy does, but, and this is where Heidegger talks about the inheritance of traditional interpretations. Those traditional interpretations are at work in the Kukule problem. And because he's not, I mean, we wouldn't necessarily expect this. I think this is very unfair criticism of McCarthy, but there is a lot of stuff in the way he's framed the problem that is traditionally inherited that requires questioning, which is what the phenomenological tradition does.
Thank you very much, Matt.